Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
For $1 today, you can buy 6.83 Chinese yuan. That was the exchange rate yesterday. It's going to be the exchange rate tomorrow, and it has Congress crying foul. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture and creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. More at producemoreconservemore.com. And by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It's great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 16th of March. You know, one country trying to control the value of its currency is really nothing new. The United States has, after all, been flooding global money markets with greenbacks for more than a year now. Of course, that was to stabilize the financial system, arguably a positive thing. Today, some members of the United States Congress accuse China of a more nefarious purpose. Not for the first time, they accused Beijing of keeping an artificial lid on the value of its money, thus boosting Chinese exports and making it harder to sell our goods there. They proposed stiff penalties on countries that engage in unfair currency manipulation. But why should we care? Sounds like a job for our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
We found the owner of a machining operation outside Flint, Michigan, who's directly affected. Lori Schmald Moncrief runs Schmald Tool and Die and says it's not just cheap Chinese labor she has to deal with. It's getting past the lopsided cost of steel or aluminum.
We can't even buy the material for the price that they're selling product for. Before I even put any labor, before I even put any cost into that raw material, I'm already too expensive.
She complains the Chinese government is essentially subsidizing its exports by keeping its currency value low. And until our government deals with that, she says, it needn't waste its time with hiring programs. Fred Bergston heads the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says there's no question the Beijing government knows what it's doing.
What they do is buy dollars and sell their own local currency, renminbi. That keeps the dollar exchange rate strong. It keeps their own currency weak. And that distorts trade flows by cheapening Chinese exports and raising the price of imports from the United States coming into China.
Some critics warn that responding with tariffs could trigger a protectionist tit-for-tat, but Bergston says the U.S. and its allies have tried to reason with Beijing.
If China continues to be recalcitrant and imposes its own hugely protectionist device of an undervalued currency, then I think it's up to other countries to defend their own interests.
In this game that all countries play, President Obama did seem to be open to some kind of new tactic when he spoke last week to the Import-Export Bank.
We need to secure our companies a level playing field. We need to guarantee American workers a fair shake. In other words, we need to up our game.
Lawmakers say support for some kind of action is so strong they expect quick passage of their bill to slap duties on certain Chinese exports. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
You want to know how far interest rates are from top of mind right now? The Federal Reserve had a meeting today and pretty much nobody noticed. Well, people did notice, but not like in the days when the Fed actually did something with interest rates. Short-term rates are going to stay right where they are, just about zero, for, in the Fed's words today, an extended period. Haiti's earthquake was a little more than 2 months ago, and in New York in a couple of weeks, major foreign donors are going to announce how much long-term aid they plan to give. Word today is that the Haitian government plans to ask for about $11.5 billion. That works out to almost $1,200 per person on that island. Brett Neely explains how they decide who gets what.
Donors asked the same question after the 2005 Indian Ocean earthquake that devastated Indonesia. Daniel Kaufman at the Brookings Institution said that country set up a special agency to handle foreign aid. It appointed Indonesians with an impeccable reputation for honesty to run it.
It did report to the president, but it had a lot of independence.
Kaufman thinks Haiti needs the same thing, but with trustees who can't be bought.
Notables like Bill Clinton, the outgoing President Bachelet from Chile, Lula, and so on.
Dan Erickson at the Inter-American Dialogue says Haiti faces another challenge.
perhaps an even bigger problem is that they just don't have the manpower or the institutions to absorb the aid effectively.
Haiti's lack of institutions turned deadly when the earthquake struck. For example, the country's lax building codes meant structures were shoddy. Erickson says donors will have to subsidize high building standards.
For example, providing certain earthquake-proof materials at a discount.
To rebuild schools, ports, and hospitals quickly, Erickson says Haiti's going to have to rely on foreign contractors.
The upside is you tend to have much better financial and accounting procedures, but the downside is that some portion of that money is actually going to be paid out, ultimately, not to Haitians, but to foreign companies.
Erickson says another downside to foreign labor is that it won't cut the country's 70% unemployment rate. The paradox is that donors will spend billions of dollars, but it may not mean jobs for Haitians. Experts say social unrest is another fault line in Haiti's future. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
The political chatter in Washington this week is mostly about the health care bill, of course. People might want to brush up on student loan rules, though, too. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser explains.
Right now, the federal government pays a subsidy to banks that make government-guaranteed student loans. The measure that's hitching a ride on the health care bill would cut out the banks. The Education Department would make the loans directly. Jack Jennings heads the Center on Education Policy.
If the middleman is eliminated, there's all sorts of money that's saved in the middle and can be mostly redirected into the further grants to students to go on to college.
Democrats say the student loan overhaul would save the government about $68 billion over 10 years. Much of that money would go toward government grants for students. The losers in all this are the banks. Scott Talbot is a lobbyist for the Financial Services Roundtable, a trade group.
We estimate about 35,000 student loan professionals would lose their jobs overnight.
Jason Delisle has an answer for that. He's a budget expert at the New America Foundation in Washington.
The Guaranteed Student Loan Program, it's not a jobs program. It's a program to ensure students get low-interest loans.
But some schools are ignoring the student loan debate. They're starting to cut out the middleman themselves. Students don't have to get their government loans through the banks. There's already a direct government loan program. The loans aren't cheaper for the students, but they're more convenient. And more schools have started offering them. Jack Jennings of the Center on Education Policy says schools are trying to maximize whatever help students may get from the government.
And so they're looking for any way they can to make the system more efficient and provide as much money as they can.
So out goes the middleman. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, after that Fed interest rate announcement, traders enjoyed the prospect of more free money to come. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Greek government got some rare positive news from the financial markets today. The ratings agency Standard & Poor's gave its budget-cutting program the thumbs up. S&P said it's taking Athens off its credit watch list. Also, Greece appears to have finally gotten the backing of its partners in the European single currency. Last night, European finance ministers came up with a plan to help the Greeks avoid default, if it does eventually come to that. Our European correspondent Stephen Beard is on the line with us from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So there is a plan to save the Greeks, but they're not really telling us what it is. Do I have that right?
That's right. We don't really know how much money is involved. We don't know what would trigger the deployment of this rescue plan. And we don't know which countries in the Eurozone would be picking up the tab. All we know is what the finance minister's chairman said last night, and he said, we have a plan.
Why all the mystery? I mean, one would think that if there is a plan, they would want the financial community to know, to be soothed by that, right?
Well, there are two schools of thought here. I mean, some say this is actually a very clever way of keeping the speculators guessing. So they're nervous about speculating against Greek government bonds or the euro because they don't know what lies in store. At the same time, this sort of keeps the pressure on the Greeks to get their finances in order. But there is another theory, and that is that there isn't a plan. That's why they've been so vague about the details. And the German finance minister lent some credence to this theory when he told the German parliament today no decisions have been made about emergency help for Greece.
Because, of course, it would be the Germans, really, the biggest economy in Europe, that would have to foot the bill.
That's right. The Germans feel the Greeks have been feckless and they should deal with the problem themselves.
Do you think, reaching the end of the great Greek debt crisis of 2010, Stephen?
No, I don't think so. I think there's a lot more coming and a lot more strains as well within the Eurozone over this. I mean, the other day we had this extraordinary thing. France, critical partner of Germany, rounded on the Germans and rather suggested that Germany was the major source of the problems in the Eurozone, the major source of imbalances, because they weren't doing enough to stimulate consumer demand within Germany and creating a sort of massive export market for Germany's Eurozone neighbours. Now, that's an old refrain, but Germans don't like it at all. When I was in Berlin recently, this was the response of analyst Heinz Schulte.
Are the Germans going to have the third bathroom in Italian marble? Are we going to buy more Greek statues? I mean, how on earth, if you look at German society, are you going to improve spending? A fourth car?
There's no doubt that the Germans really don't like being criticised when, in their view, they've done absolutely everything right economically. Neil McKinnon, a currency strategist with the VTB Group here in London, thinks there's a possibility that this could lead, in the long term, to the breakup of the Eurozone into something a bit smaller and more dependable.
Germany might say, well, we'll go our own way with like-minded countries. We're not going to be the country that writes out a blank check for other countries who are not taking the reforms that are required to get their budget deficits back on track.
But we should say the breakup of the Eurozone still does remain a pretty distant possibility.
One hates to profit from the misfortunes of others, Stephen, but is there an upside to the dollar and the United States in this?
Well, this is potential turmoil, and turmoil in America's biggest, one of America's biggest export markets is not going to be good for US exporters. But we could say one thing, the euro was supposed to rival the US dollar. I mean, when they launched this thing a decade ago, the hope was this was going to topple the greenback from its position of global dominance. Well, that now seems a very distant dream.
Stephen Beard in London with the latest on the Greek debt crisis. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
A study from the traffic information company INRIX not too long ago told all of us here in Los Angeles what we already know, that our traffic is, yes, the worst in the country. New York and Chicago are 2 and 3 on that list. Congratulations, I guess. But there was a surprise in the number 4 slot, up from 8th place just a couple of years ago. It's Washington, D.C. The capital's northern Virginia suburbs are especially clobbered, and that's put a huge strain on local businesses, which are now rethinking their politics as a result. David Schultz reports from WAMU.
Back in 2006, executives at the Janalia Farm Research Campus looked to expand into northern Virginia. They chose a site just a few miles north of Dulles International Airport. The upside? The company's team of cutting-edge neuroscientists can quickly travel to a conference anywhere in the world. The downside? Its campus is 35 miles from downtown D.C. and right in the middle of northern Virginia's crippling traffic.
We knew it was a certain number of miles, but we didn't quite understand the variability in the traffic. And I think that's some of what makes it most frustrating.
Cheryl Moore is the chief operating officer for Janalia Farm. When she first started hiring, she was shocked by how many people turned down their job offers after getting stuck in traffic on the way to an interview.
We even had someone who, on the way to her first day of work after she had accepted the position, who was stuck in traffic for, I don't know, an hour and a half or 2 hours, she quit on her cell phone on her way into work.
Businesses throughout Northern Virginia have horror stories just like this one. The daily traffic jams make everything harder, from scheduling meetings to receiving shipments. But with Republicans in control of the state capitol, it's nearly impossible to raise taxes for transportation. Virginia hasn't done it since 1987. Mark Rozell is a political science professor at George Mason University. He says some Republicans from the north are open to a limited tax increase.
But then you have the grassroots activists in the Republican Party, the conservative movement, that very strongly opposes increased taxes for any purpose. And so you have this battle brewing over the whole issue of transportation and taxes.
David Albo is a Republican legislator from Northern Virginia. He says he would support allowing his region to raise taxes on itself for itself, just not right now.
You know, I'm an economics major from University of Virginia, and it doesn't take an economics major to know that you don't raise taxes during a recession. That's a recipe for disaster. So what we've been proposing is, you know, when the economy starts turning around, we'll come back and look at this.
For Tony Howard, that's not an acceptable answer. He's the president of the Loudoun County Chamber of Commerce in Northern Virginia. Howard says the GOP's refusal to even consider a tax increase is prompting local business leaders to rethink their political ties.
Folks in the business community have given up, and I think this has happened no less than the last 10 years, have just given up caring what uniform color the politician is wearing, whether it's red or it's blue.
State legislators wrapped up their 2010 session this past weekend without even considering a comprehensive transportation bill. And with government gridlock mirroring gridlock on the highways, it'll be a tough sell for the GOP to keep the support of Northern Virginia's CEOs. I'm David Schultz for Marketplace.
Coming up, measuring the price of medicine.
If there's never anything that we read in the medical literature that has to do with cost, it might cause us not to think about the resources that we're using.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Fed's steady-as-she-goes course on interest rates helped lift stocks today. The Dow Industrials climbed 43 points, about 0.4%, to break the tape at 10,685. The NASDAQ added 15 points, about 0.2%, finished at 2,378. The S&P 500 tacked on 8 points, about 0.75%, ended things at 1159. Intel jumped nearly 4% today as it unveiled a new computer chip and forecast improved demand as the economy improves. IBM shares picked up 0.2%. Software giant Microsoft logged on to a gain of more than 0.25% today. Shares of GE gusted up more than 4.5% after the maker of jet engines and power turbines predicted profits and dividends to rise next year. Bond prices rose today. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.65%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for February. The American Bankers Association Government Relations Summit continues in Washington. Regulatory reform is the hot topic. And the White House celebrates St. Patrick's Day with a visit from the Prime Minister of Ireland, Brian Cowan. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We're going to start our letters segment today with a company that's been in the news nonstop, mostly for its cars that reportedly won't stop. A couple of weeks ago, commentator David Frum said Toyota ought to get credit for what he called the global quality revolution, thanks to an American statistician named Edwards Deming. Not long after World War II, Deming convinced Japanese manufacturers that quality could indeed be engineered into their products. Deming's name has largely dropped out of popular consciousness, but Cliff Robinson wrote from Wilmington, Delaware, to put his importance into perspective we might understand.
If the name Edwards Deming were as common as Britney Spears, we wouldn't be in such a mess.
We heard a commentary not too long ago from the president of Jackson State University, Dr. Ronald Mason. He suggested that historically black colleges and universities like Jackson State ought to join forces to survive their budget crises.
Victor Bard from Minneapolis, Minnesota, has some relatives that went to historically black colleges, and he says he doesn't totally agree with Dr. Mason, but his ideas do beat the status quo.
I think your recommendation is imperfect, but the best option for continuing the tradition of providing an HBC alternative for the foreseeable future.
Novelist Lionel Shriver was on the program last week. We talked about her new book, So Much for That. It's a tale about the true effect of healthcare costs on families of the seriously ill. One of the topics we touched on is that in real life, we don't often have the brutal conversations that her characters do about whether the cost of keeping somebody alive is worth it. Tori Norman is an intensive care nurse in Sacramento, California.
I work in an ICU, and if a patient were to say, "Let me just die, it will be too costly to keep me alive," they'd end up with getting a psychiatric consult because they're depressed. Patients get treated as something's wrong if they were making that type of decision.
Jason Viewick was with us last Friday to talk about his new book on the Yugo, The Worst Car in History, was the subtitle. We were not kind to the small Yugoslavian imports. That got Ruth Martin from Brown Summit, North Carolina, and a bunch of other people, to be honest with you, a little bit upset. Ruth said her Yugo hit 90,000 miles.
The only reason why they were not more popular was the ridiculous American obsession with big cars and luxurious appearance. I would buy one again in a heartbeat if they were available.
I don't know, Ruth. I saw one on eBay today for $1,500. Only 84,000 miles on that baby. No matter what you drive, if you've got a comment or a question about what you hear on the broadcast, please let us know. Our homepage is marketplace.org. The link you need is up in the top right-hand corner of that page. It says Contact. Now that the healthcare debate at least seems to be nearing an end, we're going to take you back closer to the beginning, to last summer and fall, and days of the arguments that care would be rationed based on how much it costs. That a bureaucrat sitting in a room someplace would look at a spreadsheet and then decide who gets what treatment or medicine. Now, though, that entire discussion has kind of been turned on its head, and there's not a whole lot of talk of cost or cost effectiveness at all. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports now on care's complicated relationship with cost.
A few months ago, a retired chemist named Mary Stowe was playing the slot machines in New Jersey when she got a huge headache, and then her arm wouldn't move. The next thing she remembers, she was waking up in the hospital and hearing she'd had a severe stroke.
They told my children I was going to die. And I recovered by some miracle.
All right, Mayor. Let's go sit on the chair.
I met Mary at the McGee Rehabilitation Center at Jefferson Hospital in Philadelphia, where she's engaged in the slow process of learning to reuse her paralyzed right arm. To do this, she's using something called robotic therapy. A therapist straps her arm to a joystick that Mary maneuvers to hit red dots on a computer screen.
I turn it from red to green.
The robot helps her make the movement.
I think it's just exercising some little muscle that I don't know about.
Technically, it's reawakening a neural pathway in her brain. This robotic technology is still pretty new, and in most hospitals, it's behavioral therapists who do this work. Mary works with both the robot and therapists, which brings up this cost question.
Which of these two alternatives provides more value per dollar spent?
Joel Hay is a health economist at the University of Southern California. He says robots might be more efficient at working with patients because they can perform the same task the same way 1,000 times.
And you'd have to sort of have repetitive, boring routines that perhaps a person wouldn't be as good at. On the other hand, a person has other advantages.
Like being able to adapt to the patient's exact needs. In this country, we spend $4.5 billion on stroke rehabilitation every year. So Hay applied for a federal grant to research which treatment, robots or therapists or some combination of both, is most cost-effective. Which is when Hay hit his first snag. I first spoke to him back in January, when provisionary language in the Senate health care bill would have made it illegal to do cost-effectiveness research with federal funds.
If I, as a university researcher, were to engage in that research and publish it, the entire University of Southern California would lose its funding for the next 5 years.
That language has been removed from the current Senate bill, thanks to advocates like David Helms, who runs Academy Health in Washington. He and others lobbied senators and got that language changed. But he says officials are still wary of funding researchers to do cost-effectiveness studies. He says the fear is
they may do this work for the government, and they then may turn around and sell the results to a health insurance association,
which could conceivably force patients to get the treatment that's cheaper. What doctors fear most is that cost-effectiveness studies will squash innovation and limit patient choice. In healthcare, policy is shaped by information, and some information is politically dangerous even to pursue. Michael Hockman is a doctor at L.A. County Hospital. He did a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association last week. He found that of hundreds of recent articles about drugs in the top medical journals, fewer than 1% compared the cost of those drugs.
And that is due to both the fact that researchers aren't doing a heck of a lot of cost-effectiveness research, but also that journals are choosing not to accept cost-effectiveness studies.
Hockman says that journal editors avoid the topic because it's controversial. And because editors are doctors, he says, they're trained to think about what's best for the patient, not what costs less.
And if there's never anything that we read in the medical literature that has to do with cost, it might cause us not to think about the resources that we're using.
Meanwhile, Joel Hay, the health economist, is still waiting to hear whether the government will fund his research on the robots used by Mary. If not,
then to do those studies, I would have to go to the robot industry. And certainly there's going to be perception that whoever funded the study is going to influence the results.
Most cost-effectiveness research is privately funded by device manufacturers and drug companies. While Mary slowly turned more red dots to green, I asked her which one she prefers, robots or people.
I like working with both human beings and dots on the machine. The dots on the machine don't complain as much.
In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by American Public Media, announcing Krista Tippett's new book, Einstein's God, Conversations About Science and the Human Spirit, available in bookstores now. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today on the way out, Eli Lilly has been robbed, big time too. Sometime over the weekend, somebody drove a tractor trailer up to the drug maker's warehouse in Enfield, Connecticut, drove off with $70 million worth of prescription drugs. They cut a hole in the roof, let themselves in, and started loading up. The haul included the antidepressants Prozac and Cymbalta and an antipsychotic as well, Zyprexa. The company does say there aren't going to be any supply disruptions as a result of the theft. Police figure the drugs are going to wind up being fenced through an online pharmacy, which I thought was kind of interesting. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 43 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ rose 15 points, 2/3%. The S&P 500 added 8 points, about 0.8%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this broadcast, serving up a new way to eat lunch at school.
Everyone wants to do the right thing and have the healthiest choices, the healthiest environment for our students. But for us as a district, it all boils down to cost.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.